Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Okay, welcome to the podcast. Today we have Wayne Areola. He's a leader in software testing or continuous testing, integration, and all things DevOps. Welcome, Wayne.
You expanded my role pretty significantly there, Michael. I love it. Thank you.
Had no choice.
It couldn't go downhill, right?
Make a good introduction these days, don't we? Carl, over to you, mate, to ask to kick off our first question.
Well, thanks, Michael. Very formal of you. Wayne, 6 patents, 2 books. I mean, you're a very busy man. Is there another book in the pipeline at the moment? Or, you know, what's happening on your side?
You know, writing books is very rewarding when it's done, but it's so painful. It is such a painful process. So you have to make sure that you are teed up for the road ahead. So with that being said, I think, there's got to be, but I think this conversation today will solidify whether I do it or not. And let me tell you why. I'm here at your invitation, obviously, which I thank you both for inviting me. But I think software testing itself, as well as DevOps, is at an inflection point, meaning that we got to take another change. We got to take another turn. I think if this podcast is successful and we get an audience who believes maybe a lot of what I'm talking about, and I'm sure you guys are going to agree, maybe there is another book in the future.
It's funny. I remember being compared to sort of having a baby where, you know, you kind of, you know, it's a huge amount of stress and pain and drama. And then as soon as it's finished, you kind of like, oh, that was amazing. And you forget about all the bad stuff. And then you're like, oh, I want to do it again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that is true. Except for the fact that the baby follows you for 18 years afterwards. And the book only lasts like 6 months.
Oh, if only the kids were the same, eh? I mean, Wayne, you've always been at the forefront, right? You know, in regards to the thought leadership in the testing space. So, I mean, obviously at the moment, we've seen a bit of a disruption to the market with what's happening with COVID, remote work. There's now more focus on, you know, automation while still remaining working as a team, even in sort of a distributed space. But I mean, once those things sort of start to settle down, what do you think that next step is going to be? What are people sort of looking for within the testing space as the next evolution?
So to unpack that loaded question, and by the way, audience, he has never asked me that before. It's true. He has. This is the first time we're addressing it. And I think there's a lot of facets to it. I think if you really look down deep inside your software testing soul, you'll realize that a lot of what we're doing does not make sense. And whether it is that, you know, your corporate agreements with a global systems integrator has gone a little haywire, and you're committed to some agreements that you might not find as productive, whether you are or you're required to shift resources in order to achieve, you know, faster cycle times, you know, according to your desired agile state. Or if you're talking about, you know, just do we really know what we're doing when it comes to testing? I think all of those ideas can be challenged. Gosh, just sounds like a book. I'm getting so depressed already. So all these ideas can be totally challenged. And, I think what COVID did, guys, I think it basically said, okay, we're now really highly distributed. Now what? And it put pressure on the outsourcing relationship. It put pressure on what do I have access to and what I don't have access to. It put pressure on everything but the tool to really develop the functionality, meaning that if you really wanted to write an automated test today, there's some fantastic commercial tools out there, and there's 1.5 million free and open source tools that do really a slice of a little bit of something, right? And I think they're all okay in terms of driving automation. But the pressure I think we find, or the collision point which COVID introduced, was, okay, are we really all on the same page, and how do I really get on that same page to do what's necessary with that tool, right? And I think that's really where the idea comes in, that we're at a point of change, because I don't think we're ever going to go back to the way we were working before.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because, I mean, if you look at the automation space, like you said, open source, you've got a stack of libraries which do like an individual thing where there might be a specific API framework or a type of, you know, UI automation. And there's been a huge amount of investment in that sort of automation space. Whereas fundamentally, and Michael, we've been working in testing for a long time as well. And it's a case of, well, what about requirements management and test mapping and all those things? That's kind of been left to the side, and that's where a majority of the problems are as well. So have you seen anything, Wayne, on your side, obviously being stateside, in investment in that area as well?
Yes, and this is a real interest area to me right now, there'll be more to come, and hopefully we can reflect back on this podcast and say I told you so at one point. But you know, I think let me just kind of reset the conversation here real quickly. I think if you talk to anyone in the software testing space, they would start the conversation around design, develop, test, deploy. Design, develop, test, deploy. And if you put it in a line, you'd get yelled at, you know, by the Agile guys, because you had to put it into an affinity in order to make it really DevOps. And you're like, fine, okay, we'll make it continuous. But the one thing, and I think this is the fundamental difference, is everything should start from production. Mm. About what's happening today. And I think we as developers, quite honestly, and distinctly as testers, are not taking that information, which is so readily available, and assisting us to make better decisions. I think that is the first and the foremost, the single thing that we need to do better, right? So if you look at just a litany of different systems that are out there today, there's so much information that time after time, I do not see testers use, right? So let's start. Source diffs. Yeah, you might see some of that, you know, and they might have a change impact thing, but and how does that impact the way you're constructing, prioritizing tests? I don't know. If you look at APM and the value and the significant amount of information that APM systems provide in terms of actual user journeys, actual, you know, central points in terms of, you know, what components are more important or priority and what gets hits the most, where are the high traffic areas, is that being injected into how you are actually either spending your time iterating for the future or not? No. Are you looking at really the record of defect tracking, right? And really what's valuable? Let me give you a little bit of I just did a little survey out there. We got 500 respondents in LinkedIn in roughly 3 days, which is phenomenal. And I asked a question. I said, given your in-sprint regression tests, and I did describe functional regression tests at this point, what percentage of those defects found are actually fixed within the sprint? I asked, give me a severity 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Well, severity 1 being horrible, severity 4 being not so bad. Give me an idea of those defects found, what gets fixed in sprint. Would you guys want to take a guess on what the number was?
Real numbers, or I don't know.
You can round up, you can round down, you can do whatever you want. Just what percentage of defects actually found get in a sprint get fixed within the sprint?
15%.
15.
I'll go.
Higher or lower? This is like Price is Right.
I'll go 10%.
10%. It's 12. Yeah, it was 12%. So you guys, you know what?
Like, split the difference.
I hate doing this thing with smart people. You guys aren't going to get the answer. But it was 12%. So 12% of defects being found. And then I asked a question, you know, if the defect is not found within the sprint, what's the likelihood of it getting addressed? And I noted, I go, give me a wild ass guess, because it's, you know, I'm sure that this is not going to be, this can't be scientific at this point in time. And they basically said about there's a 20% chance of that defect being fixed, if at all, right? If it's not addressed within the sprint itself. So, and I mean, this is why you have a defect management system, right? Because you need to collect all the stuff. Sorry, we're in the podcast. You got to collect all the stuff that you're not addressing and decide whether you got to address it or not. So, I mean, it just kind of goes to show you, two things. It's like, are we really taking the time to do what's required? And compared to what we do find, is it important? And I don't think we're able to answer those questions quite readily enough, right? So back to the original question, you know, where does this really go? Or, you know, what's the impact? I think we got to use data to understand what we should be doing much, much better. And just to kind of round this out, I'm not talking AI, ML, the PFM ball on the blackboard that tells you that data comes in here and magic comes out the other one, right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that we have pure data that we're ignoring. Mm-hmm. And even these ideas of AI and ML and deep learning have, I think, hindered some of the thinking of practitioners, thinking that there is magic on the way. So it's a big discussion. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think AI, ML has a huge, huge role in how components are developed in the future, right? Huge role. But today, I think we have a lot of answers in front of us that we're really not taking advantage of.
And the simplicity of that, Wayne, isn't it? Making it simple to start with and layer in the
agreed.
Yeah. And that way. And look, from my research and also and Carl's and I personal delivery experiences, sometimes you need a strategy. Now, I'm not saying you have a 100-page strategy on your automation.
No.
But it needs to be something that is endorsed by top-down, bottom-up approach of the company or IT. And it's not something that's done on the side. So a lot of this automation initiatives are done on the side sometimes. And that's what hurting a bit, we find. How do you find that? Is it something that's lacking?
Let's flip this around. Yeah. Well, let's flip it around. Let me ask you guys a question. Carl, Michael, you know, you mentioned something there, Michael, about is it received top down? And, you know, I think one of the biggest problems, and I want to ask your opinion about this, is that you really don't have strategy when it comes to test. You just have the clock. Mm. And what I mean by that is my feeling is that people have basically ignored strategy and looked to test as being tactical.
Yep.
Do you guys agree? I don't know. I mean, I'd love to hear more.
That's I would say yes. That's yep. the case. Yeah.
I would say most people from the top down don't care about testing itself. As long as the product is functioning and is going to make them money, then that's what they care about. And the actual act of testing and the strategy and everything else is, you know, manure, so to speak, or it's just noise. And so it should just basically align with, you know, the company strategy around, you know, products, features, and whatever that might be as well.
Got it.
Yeah. And hey, also commoditized. I say the word commoditized. It's seen as a commodity.
So let's go for the mind-blowing concept here for a second. I don't believe that applications out there, I don't believe that quality is that bad. I really don't. In fact, I think you could probably ignore testing. I'm going to go that far. Okay. Now I get you. There's compliance. There's other issues. There's, you know, end user risk. There's competitive situations. There's other reasons why you might like to test. But I don't really think that application quality is that bad.
I agree. So let's put a hypothetical out there. The three of us were tomorrow to go to start a business. And the first thing we need to do was, you know, get a CRM, for example, to obviously put together and start making sales. And we could go and pick one off the shelf. We would not have to test anything.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
In reality. Right. And I think as us, if we were operating in a very lean fashion and we said, well, we're not going to build anything custom, let's look and align to the best of our requirements, what we need. We could probably bolt three of them together and we would not need to, outside of maybe going, yep, that works great. Let's go.
So let's take level of complexity one, where I take a vanilla instance of some sort of CRM system and use it out of the box. Yep. Would I test?
Not necessarily. Yeah. You do some light testing. You do some basic lights, maybe shakedown type of approach. If your confidence levels and your risk appetite.
Okay.
In the way of that.
Okay. So the next thing I would do is obviously, unless we're a startup, totally greenfield, and all we have is our three names in the database. And let's assume there's more. The first thing I would do is integrate the database, right? And then the question would be, okay, would I test? Yeah, okay. There is a level of validation that I want at that point in time. Okay.
The data's okay, there, then great, yeah.
Yeah, now the CRM system needs to connect with my order management system.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we have the infamous API. And depending on the SaaS vendor we're talking about, right, I would say that that's your next point of pain, right? Do I integrate? Do I test? And I would say no. I'd say if the API seems to be working on case one, I'm just going to assume it's going to work on case 1,000. Right? So I don't think I'd test.
Yeah, and it's also, and there's that conversation around testing, formalizing it and doing some light testing and not writing a million test cases and trying to test everything, that type of approach. Just give enough to get the vanilla flavored approach out the way and maybe some negative.
Well, I don't even think you'd document anything. I think it was the three of us, like you said, Wayne, you'd be like, yep, that looks good.
Yep.
Let's go. You know, there'd be no strategy. There'd be no documentation. It's just, we're done. Okay. We're ready to rock and roll.
And by the way, that's pretty simple. We're three guys who just started a business. Congratulations, Carl. You're in charge of the CRM, by the way.
You're done, mate.
Awesome. Fantastic. But I mean, that's quite a common situation here, though. Again, I guess so, you know, in the state side, you know, business is a bit different in the structure. But I guess, you know, for the podcast for our listeners here in Australia, 99% of businesses in Australia are a small business. And that's a very relevant scenario for a lot of people who might be going down that route where they need a bit of technology as well. So
agreed. But you know what? You might want to get a little sophisticated, and then you use some sort of online API test. You ping it. You do something, or you know, you hopefully the browser doesn't have too many components or operations or objects that make it too complex to use. So you can use some sort of browser test. But I don't think, I mean, to get to the point where you're really going to consider test automation, I think you're at a point where you're de-risking. The next step I would say is you're de-risking the process risk by actually giving a project to a consultant who's done it before.
Yeah.
And make it their problem, right?
Yep.
Exactly. It's risk mitigation approach, right? That's what testing is. Yeah. And basically it's just having that in place, that strategy in place to mitigate it. Really? What size?
But then let's take, you know, so since we've gone to that extreme, let's go to the other extreme. You know, you're a bank, or one of the big four banks of Australia that everyone loves to hear about, who are, by the way, technology forward, in from my perspective, comparatively to the US, technology forward, and but still risk averse, with compliance needs and reporting. And still a plethora, I like saying that word, of integrated systems, on average over 1,000, right? Systems that are being bandaged together. And you do have highly sensitive, critical, I hate saying mission critical, so I didn't, I just said critical, transactions going through. And at this point in time, I would say you have the right to not only your government, your users, your investors, and your customers to validate the changes you make are not going to ruin their life.
Yeah. Return on investment in the shareholdings of that, right? The dividends that come, right? That's a big one.
Yeah.
Data.
But now let's take what just happened to our industry over the last 7 years. I was going to say 10, but it makes me seem so old. But let's say what happened over the last 7 years. So we went to Agile and we made Agile almost imperative. Some form of Agile. Okay, let's just be honest. Everyone's somewhere in between, right? We have very few Agileistas out there still. And obviously the American President Trump will never address the Agileistas. So, you know, you have those extremists, right? And then you have, you know, every kind of iteration in between, and then you have DevOps that sped everything up, right?
Sure.
Which actually put more of a need to understand the impact of change in front of the organization making the change. And I think this is where the delta starts. You know, getting back to the initial question associated with our podcast is, you know, where are we today and where do we need to go? I really don't think people understand the impact of change across their end-to-end systems at all. I mean, zero. And building a regression suite from the bottom up without really understanding the technical implications of what they're changing. That means code dependencies, you know, performance and functional impact. I think people really are still hoping for the best when they start with the current suite. They make minor changes to the, or they try to make global changes to the regression suite if they have that, right? And then say, hey, okay, I think we're going to be cool. And there's a number of different things that I think get in the way. First of all, no one is ever going to have the complete environment to actually test that thing. Right. And then if you did have the complete environment to test that, the changes, the impact of those changes, the data associated with it is going to be, you know, almost impossible to generate. In the time period, right? It's not going to be impossible to generate if you had a year, but it's for the time period of hopefully the shorter iteration that, or that DevOps is trying to inject into the equation. So I think no matter what, if you go roll it all back, understanding the impact of change is the first question, right? The second question I think is, what's the priority versus the impact of that change? Yeah. Meaning that I think today a lot of people are trying to do better design, but the practice then gets shoved out the window immediately because people tire from design. But I don't understand why design can't be totally automated.
I agree. 100%. This is a good segue, Wayne, into... So you're fortunate, you live in California, right? And you have a lot of access to venture capital people, right? And organizations. Research I did a couple of years ago was really focused on the development and the testing, automation and investment, basically, was to get the headcount down of how many people work in those areas. But really, as Carl mentioned before, it was requirements and design that really is still manual, but yet doesn't get the attention that it deserves. Is that where VC should be focusing, or are they focusing that now for the next 10 years? Is that being looked at?
So, you know, I don't think we need to look to the VCs for the answers, because they're the ones who really invest in the good story that is proven or potentially proven. I think it relies on people like us. And, you know, the organizations to raise their hands and say, I have pain. But if you go back to it, to your question, simply my answer is yes to your question. I go, yes, you know, anything that allows us to use automation to prioritize what needs to occur from a testing perspective, or to find your in sprint regression testing using data, number one. And then two, anything that allows us to actually define risk without going back in and manually adjusting something, is I think absolutely critical. And we're back to this idea that, you know, quite honestly, I think there's enough good functional testing tools out there where the actual creating the drivers or leveraging a platform that has the driver that can be manipulated by either code or a model is, I think there's enough out there. I think the real question comes back down to, you know, do we truly know what we're doing, and how do I reduce the duplication of effort in order to get there within the time frame of a sprint, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, speed, you're right. The speed's the highest priority, but do we need to, because I do look at the numbers of my career. I looked at like doing a lot of testing and then looking at how long it took for requirements to be developed and the quality of those and design. And that took a long time. And I think that area needs help, support and nurturing to speed that up. As you've said, there's plenty of testing tools out there now to speed up automation, right? It's just a matter of how you manage that and have the maturity of people to implement that. Now, I think it is very, very clear. But yeah, I think there's a software delivery life cycle. As you mentioned before, you've got to get the data first from production, what's wrong, to then filter it through your software delivery life cycle. So that is your go right to go left approach.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So I also think that,
at its very basic form, there's only three types of defects. The first type of defect is that it's a poor coding. Mm. And that usually gets ferreted out because fundamentally, you know, things are just not working, right? And it usually gets fleshed out. The second is a poor requirement, which I think 80%, I was going to say 90%, but I didn't want to be so bold. 80% of the defects that are found out there is really a poor requirement, meaning it's probably ill-defined or the complexity of it, you know, it has further ramifications that you didn't anticipate. And as you guys all know, once you crack into code, you know, it's kind of like remodeling your house. You're going to find something that you didn't expect in the way. Right. And then the last defect isn't really a defect at all. It's a missing requirement, meaning that it has become evident that we didn't think this thing through because what we thought was a defect was actually just a missing requirement. No one really asked for it before, but the way that the system has evolved, now it becomes, you know, somewhat more urgent to address. And if you look at those three categories, you can kind of understand why what we do in testing only, you know, 12% gets addressed in sprint, because it's usually what's been poorly implemented rather than what is a missing requirement or a poor requirement, right? Mm. Because at the poor requirement phase, what usually has happened is the team has decided, hey, we don't know what we don't know, so we're just going to go for it. And we're either going to pull the feature before the release, or we're going to you know, find out what we can, and you know, with full likelihood that this thing rolls into the next sprint. So, you know, with that, that still impacts testing. So you still have a team out there who's prepping all this stuff, you know, likely not really caring what matters. So we're at an inflection point, guys. Mm-hmm. If you really think about it. And there's another piece to this story I think that's pretty interesting. I think over the last 5 years, I don't think five, maybe less than that, like 4 years, over the last 4 years, there is something that has happened that is phenomenal. Developers have accepted much, much more of the onus of quality than they have ever had previously. And this also means that your approach to testing doesn't have to be, you know, making sure everything's the letter of the law anymore. You could be more creative, or you should be more creative. I mean, if you evolve testing to be more, you know, maybe, you know, usability or UX requirement definition, right? You know, it'd be very interesting to see how you would optimize your time. You know, so if you take those, if you would accept that there's only three levels of defects, bad code, poor requirement, missing requirement, two of those ideas are in the improve UI UX category. Obviously, there's things that can functionally be missing, but you know, two of those are future oriented, and only one of them is really focused on today. Mm. But that's not the way we spend our time, by the way, right? Yeah. The way we spend our time today is there's a new user story. I'm going to scramble like mad to be creative as possible, to come up with tests and permutations and whatever, to actually exercise all the potential paths associated with the change. I hate to say it. I just think it's a waste of time.
Mm. That's a good point. And it comes down to a cost conversation. Carl mentioned Look, my research shows, when I was writing my book too, the number one thing was the high costs of IT, right? Just a generic conversation there. And obviously there's a lot of small businesses in Australia, and I'm finding that they spend so much on IT that they have no money left for anything for marketing. And you know, as you know, Wayne, your marketing background, they have enough for marketing or getting the product out to market or engaging the market. They've just burnt their budgets in IT. Do you find it's still a cost problem for IT globally at the moment in general that needs to get it down to make IT more relevant in the future, you know, to give it the more better respect? Or
so let, you know, let, let's pop the conversation up to like the mid market and even bigger at this point. You know, at the lower end, I think we've come to the conclusion that you're probably going to be using some package applications, and you know, you're probably going to outsource any kind of nominal changes to those systems to a partner who is going to take full responsibility for the quality of the changes they made. And you know, are you going to test? No. Should you test? No. You shouldn't. You really shouldn't. Should you, you know, kind of humanly validate the expected outcome? Absolutely. No doubt about it. Okay. Now let's pop up a bit and say, okay, we're in the mid-market area. We have some distinct risks associated because we're a business, bigger business. And now what you're saying is I got to layer in some costs associated, extended costs associated to doing business. Right. And I think this gets back down to the idea that we just don't know really what it takes. Because if we were using the data from production to truly understand the patterns, I think you could encapsulate what's truly necessary. And there's two pieces to that. I think you really don't have to test as much as we're doing today. I think people are generally over-testing by 3 to 6x.
I agree.
And I also think that if you can use data to better understand what those change patterns are or change impacts are, you could significantly reduce that and get a positive business outcome, right? And I'm not saying ship crap software. I just want to let everybody know I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is the incremental difference between the level of activity that we're putting behind our testing activity today versus the costs associated with it, I don't think it's worth it, even in an outsourced relationship. Now, let's throw a big bomb out there. Let's talk about the GSIs. I believe that the problem we face today in terms of not leveraging data is primarily predicated on the global systems integrators saying that I got hordes of manual testers available. Why should you care? Mm. Right? We're just going to throw people at it. They're going to do whatever. And I think there's been two major impacts for that. And the first one is there's been really slow adoption of automation because, quite honestly, as a CIO or as a VP of dev or as a VP of quality, I de-risked my release by outsourcing it, right? Not my problem. It is my problem, but I outsourced it to a certain degree. And what I did is I traded this idea of automating it versus using labor arbitrage to mitigate the risk elsewhere, right? With people. I kind of pushed it off to the side. You know, there's probably a good analogy here about, you know, your home, whether you, you know, are you going to really invest in that new Wi-Fi mesh network that you really want, or are you going to get that thing that plugs in the wall and it's going to allow you to extend your Wi-Fi router just enough to get through your next couple Zoom meetings. I'm guilty. I've done it, right? I got that thing that plugged in the wall. It doesn't work anymore, by the way. So I think that the way that we've evolved testing as a tactic, especially through labor arbitrage and with the GSIs, has also hampered the way we've approached the market and hampered the way we've approached software testing.
Yeah, I agree with the data approach because it's easy to say, yes, reduce your testing scope, but getting the facts in place to do that and collecting that data and taking that to the stakeholders in a client who's got that, who does bring in their third parties outsource arrangements for testing, but to having getting that data and put it into a very simple process or, you know, diagram or something to consume that information to make that decision to reduce your testing scope. That's where it needs to go, isn't it? It's about getting that data.
For a couple of reasons, and you know, Carl, I think you'll appreciate this. I mean, A, you know, if you're using the data, ingesting the data from consistent sources, it's repeatable, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could tweak your algorithm to adjust what you want to do or how you want to invest, right? Parameterize it to get more to allow you to make better decisions on the action. Or what do? Just build more tests? I mean, your alternative to not using the data is to provide coverage using people to do it manually or augment that manual effort via automation. So go ahead.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting because I think, like you said, Wayne, with a GSI, like everyone is used to that model where I've got bodies, you don't need to worry about it, right? And I think you're right. It's had a two-prong problem, really. The first is that if we look at it, the lack of innovation that comes with that because, well, I can basically capitalize on my human resources. The second problem I see is that most testers are wimps and will not challenge or add value in any way, shape, or form in regards to the testing process. They'll simply go, oh, okay, the BA said this or the dev said this, and I'm just going to follow and do what I need to do and hence increase the coverage.
Yeah.
And they're not really providing a thought leadership to say, well, hang on, guys, we need to look at, you know, other objects here. We've got a Dynatrace instance. Let's use that. You know, let's pull the data in and see where our hotspots are and focus specifically on that. They're not encouraged or really, I guess, you know, amortized to provide that level of feedback to anyone.
But Michael, Carl, why are they wimps? Why is this the case?
Well, yeah, we reckon, Carl, there's a couple of angles, eh?
Well, my opinion on this is because really testing doesn't create anything. So whereas a developer can sort of push back and say, well, okay, you go get someone else to build something to the quality that I can or that looks as pretty, very little people will look and go, oh, wow, that guy added a lot of value as a tester because something's bound to break during the cycle, right? It's something you're bound to have issues in production and hence there's this seamless. Know how good that tester is? If something gets past them, they haven't really added the value that the business expects. Yeah. Other than that, I guess they're probably used to being the last one in the chain and hence bottom of the rung. Maybe it's a mental thing.
My hypothesis is if something is going to get past them that is egregious, like a production outage, they're never going to find it in test.
Mm.
Right. Unless, you know, someone did something as stupid as opening a connection to the database and then, you know, putting in a recursive string that expands and blows up the database, like something that's so stupid, right? Mm-hmm. That can be caught by static analysis. But I don't think they're going to catch it. So let's take this idea that you just mentioned, because I really like it. You said testers really don't create anything. And I agree. I think we need to shift their mantra. Where they're, what they should be creating are defect prevention strategies rather than tests. Because at the end of the day, now there's another complexity I just got to add here. At the end of the day, the developer has increasing onus of or responsibility of quality, right? But the component in which they're concerned about is fairly myopic or very encapsulated. Someone's still got to take the end-to-end view of the business, but they should be talking about how to mitigate that risk. And testing might be one of the components, but I don't think that the testers have really fully thought about how to evolve their role to become contributors to the business strategy. And that could be that little, it sounds like just another way, you mentioned my marketing background, so I'm a little embarrassed. That could be another background. That could be another way to just say the same thing as a test, but it's not, right? It's really not. It's you should be thinking about things so far upstream.
Yes.
That, you know, what happens is we're going to go build a requirement around X. Great. What's all the data around X? Well, what are the dependencies? What's all the data? What should you consider? What should be built into the requirement rather than, because if you took that idea of what should be built into the requirement as your activity, you would actually, if you believe that there's only three defects, that would actually take care of the last two categories, where the first category is really all about the developer. Meaning that you would actually be able to now say, hey, we're missing this piece of the requirement. And next you'd actually say you're missing a whole requirement, right?
Actually flagging it. You're right. I mean,
a whole new industry.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I mean, I remember one of the things when we used to work for the telcos, you know, and I would take the team down and say, okay, let's basically go into the life of the customer and go and purchase a SIM from a retail outlet. And then you can see the whole flow from there and understand what they're going through. And what the person at the end of the day is the CSR is also going through as well. And I think that loss of touch, most of the people who work on these sprints will never, ever touch a production system or actually participate in the business in any way, shape, or form. So how can they actually look after the business when they don't understand it themselves?
What's a strategy thing? And going back to what you're saying before, Carl, is what I see in these scrum teams is that there's one test and it's a 5-7 developers, right? So they're, before they start, they're already drowned out. Their voice is drowned out to be supported to do that. Also, if there's no strategy above these scrum teams on testing, as you mentioned, they're way upstream, to then call out and should, you know, test the requirements before you even worry about developing them, you know, put into code. That strategy is not there. I feel it's been lost totally. It's the strategic side before you even get to there. And but also, you need to see management and leadership supporting the testing process when there is that 1-7 ratio when it comes to testing.
I mean, so even if we took, say, 7 scrum teams, right, within one, you know, one enterprise, and okay, albeit they might be working on different technology, but if we were to just grab, say, open up the Jira projects and have a look, would the requirements look exactly the same? Could I jump from one sprint, you know, team to the other without having, you know, with minimal disruption? Would the tests look the same? I mean, so I think this comes back to what you said, Wayne. The problem is that there is no standardization when it comes to requirements. It's basically, it's interpretation. And the problem is that interpretation can be taken, you know, one of many ways. Yeah. You could write something and me and Michael could look at it and take a completely different view on it if we were a developer.
Exactly right.
I was just on a project, a smaller project this week or last week, excuse me, with a team from India. And we spent, I spent a lot of time explaining myself. And then when there was questions, I would write it down and send it back. And I was shocked at what came back. Was almost nowhere close to what I had ordered. And there was two major things that happened. One was the interpretation. It really was. It was just the interpretation of what my English meant to them. And, I go back and I go, you know, is this my fault? How do I fix it? And it's not without being there face to face and explaining once they had a question that we would have caught some of these nuances. That's number one. The second thing, which is always kind of interesting to me, is the developers' ideas on how to make it better, you know, while they're actually implementing the requirement themselves, right? So it's almost like, hey, it's totally human nature to try to improve it, right? And there was, I would say it was about 50-50. Half of it was a misinterpretation. Half of it was, hey, I'll make this better for you. It was, you know, quite impressive. I mean, I would say 10-20% of the I'll make it better for you actually did make it better. But the rest of it, the 85-90% was like, oh, God, guys, let's back it up a little bit, right? You know, there's one other thing, and maybe this is for another podcast, guys, but, there's one other concept that kind of maybe comes to the pinnacle of our conversation, which is, I've always argued that QA and testing should have reported to ops in an ops thread rather than dev. And I think reporting to dev is really where I was gonna make a bad joke, but I mean, if you're gonna turn in your exam, this is the clean version of the bad joke. If you were gonna turn in your exam and your professor is gonna tell you only where you're wrong, but you as a student held the power over the professor, right? Yeah, guess what, professor? Nice opinion, but
you know.
Go get your tweed jacket with the patches and take a walk, right? I think that relationship is not a healthy interaction.
Yeah.
I think if it really reported to ops, and I know everyone's big one happy DevOps family these days, but if really they were more ops focused and protecting the business from a risk and operations perspective, I think they would have levered up their power. I think they would have had access to environments and data that that testers wouldn't have had before. And I really do believe that the feedback to
to developers would have been critical, because ops could have basically said, sorry guys, not doing it this week. This sucks. Take it back. Right? You know?
No, you're right. And also in that ops model also is the risk department in a regulated environment. You know, I know I've been in situations where I've reported directly into risk, and it's made a whole difference to the independent implementation of the testing process.
Yeah.
You know, and reporting to the business. I agree with you, Wayne. I've seen more success when it has had the management has been the business and ops.
Yeah, agree.
More success.
But we should talk about that. We should do another podcast on that.
Oh, I agree.
Let you guys exhaust the broad array of Australian resources.
Absolutely. So, Wayne, I guess, are there any, what brands do you look at and think that's, you know, a shining example of quality? Like, do you look at anyone, I mean, even outside the IT space, say, look, just go, yeah, these guys have got it down, and that's like a product that I would use and trust just based on, you know, the quality that it issues. Is there anything in particular that stands out for you?
You mean from a consumer experience?
Yeah, from a consumer experience perspective, yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, by the way, no one has had a lack of fault. And I would say the continuity of some of these brands in my mind has always been, and this goes back to one of the premises that we have. It's like, you know, software's not that bad. It's like not that bad. However, the examples that I do use, you know, quite honestly, is Capital One. I don't know if you guys are have access to their systems or their products. Seems to always be okay, right? If they do have something that doesn't go bad, if they do have something that goes bad, it doesn't seem to be reflected in my experience. And B, I see that my experience is continuously evolving, and that other people are following the things that they are doing from the interface perspective, or from, you know, I think they were one of the first people to do the, you know, the double authentication. They were the first people to do kind of the new layout. They kind of took a more comprehensive approach to say, hey, the user is more sophisticated and I should give the sophistication back to the user. And they've incrementally delivered that, I think, in a way which has been quite reasonable without necessarily outages. Yet, I'd also say that some of the other banking experiences I had, everyone always goes back to banks, really, have not been so great. If you look at Amazon, too, Amazon's a great experience. I mean, even if it's a shoddy interface, or it used to be a shoddy interface, and it's hard to find things, but if everyone shops Amazon the way I shop Amazon, I go look for what I want first, and then I go see how much it costs at Amazon, right? And if you put enough information in, you're gonna get your answer pretty fast. I think that experience has been pretty good over time. And I think both. And I'm not using these as examples of folks who are early adopters of DevOps, but they're both very early adopters of DevOps.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least in the Capital One and in the Amazon case, you know, some of the poster children for DevOps. You know, my Google experience has not been great, just between you and I. If you've moved over to the Google suite of products for, you know, the Office competitors of Word and PowerPoint and whatnot, I've lost data working in that environment. Microsoft, I lost data in their own environment, right? Hasn't been as seamless, and there's been complexities associated with that. What else though? I think Capital One and I think Amazon are two pretty good examples. And I think the idea there is that they truly do hold the user as the most important piece of the puzzle. And they will risk giving the user a wow moment and speed, you know, for the sake of testing, right? I don't think that they're really spending time and cycles really concerned over testing, because the idea of giving the value back to their core customers is just so great to them.
Interesting. I agree with you.
I'd love to hear your opinions, though.
I think, you know, you're right. My Google and my GCP experience has not met the standards that I'm used to from AWS. I think AWS is a cloud provider as well, in regarding to providing platform to develop on. I find Google does have a lot of options, but it's quite cluttered in the way it's laid out. And I can get through it, but it's not as seamless. Whereas Amazon's like, yep, click here, bang. Okay, there's your box. Go away. Go have fun.
Go.
Same with Azure. I think that, again, the Gmail platform compared to, say, Outlook, toss a coin, depending. I've had troubles with both. I think the banks here do a very good job with regards to mobile banking. Michael, yeah, I don't know if that's experience for you, but like it's the biggest problem is, okay, if there's an outage on pay run day, then you're going to have people screaming. But apart from that, it's incredibly stable. And I think my opinion is we now live in a world where the customers have become hyper fickle and it's very, very difficult to keep everyone happy. And I think a lot of the time you've got to drown out the noise and say, well, we've got a solid base of customers here that are happy with what we do.
Yeah.
Let's continue to innovate. And, you know, the noise will always be the noise, and filtering that can be difficult. But what about you, Mike? What about yourself?
So I've been using a lot of CBA lately with trading, which has been very good, I have to say. Especially buying that. When it comes to user experience from a crypto point of view, I use Bitfinex, right? That works pretty well. It has had its issues or legal issues, but the interface is good. And APIs are good, especially if you're doing algorithmic trading. I find that's pretty good from that technical perspective. But I have to say, in Australia, the banks are held up to the media quite heavily. And they're servant to that. So I'm finding that the apps are always seem to be pretty good, right? They have issues. Everything gets, things do go wrong, right? But I'm finding that is the case. But Capital One's popped up in my research a lot, Wayne. Even so, I'm not a consumer.
Yeah.
It's popped up consistently across a lot of the research of co-quality and business engagement. Yeah. Definitely. When you mentioned that before, and it really stood out. Yeah. Especially the last 2 years, particularly.
I think the only other one I would say that I would consider it hold to be a Zoom competitor shortly would be Discord. Really, really. I mean, started off in the gaming community, but it's crystal clear sound quality. They're now moving into video streaming. I think they're an up and comer. They're the one to watch out for as well.
Interesting. I mean, even disrupting everything that's going on in the streaming marketplace, you think they could really?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Have
a hit for Twitch and everything else as well. I think they're going to be an up and comer.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. That is really interesting. So guys, can we do this again? I have two more ideas I want to pitch.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about this ops and where should testers report to?
Without doubt.
Because I will also share with you an article I wrote and how I got hammered. I mean, just hammered by the QA community on how stupid I was.
But you want to be one. You want the information flow back, right? You want to be able to,
absolutely.
I still think I'm right. I mean, that's how stupid I am.
Well, provide us the link and we can put it definitely in the footer for our notes of the podcast, Wayne. So, absolutely.
And I'll also provide you a link to this this article around how the global system integrators have potentially hampered our evolution of automation.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's definitely going to be a talking point from our experience as well. So, Wayne, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. It's always entertaining and it's always, you know, amazing to pick your brain as well. Thank you very much for joining us. We know the time zones aren't always friendly. So we definitely look forward to having you on again. And I think, like you said, we've got definitely taken a few topics out of today that we'll address shortly.
Guys, thank you so much. And, you know, just for the record, Michael was drinking water. I was drinking a beer because it is 5 o'clock in Los Angeles right now.
Oh, very good. Very good. Monday and Tuesdays. All right. Thanks, Wayne. Pleasure having you, mate. Pleasure.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Good to talk to you.
Cheers.
Bye.